Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, August 14th, 2017. I'll be working a half week and then heading off on vacation starting Thursday. The podcast should resume about August 29th. Lots of news to comment on today following the white supremacist demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia, that led to the car ramming death of a 32-year-old woman who was a counter-protester to the racists who had assembled in her town. And this really reveals a lot about Donald Trump. As you know, in his first fumbled response, a quick statement issued from his golf club in New Jersey on Saturday midday, he really fumbled. And I feel that it was a case of kind of self-exposure, indecent exposure of the racist variety. Because Trump felt compelled to say that, you know, the violence there was initiated by many sides. And it's clear there was only one side that went violent. And it remains to be seen what motivated the 20-year-old man from Maumee, Ohio, to get in his Dodge Charger and mow people down and then back up and mow some other people down. But the tone was set last year by Donald Trump in the campaign where he openly identified with some of the most extreme racist white elements in this country. Oh, and he gave a rote denunciation of David Duke when he was forced to. But it was just like the insincere statement that he recited from the White House today. But not before he attacked an African-American CEO of Merck, the giant chemical and pharmaceutical company. Ken Frazier announced early this morning that he was resigning from the American Manufacturing Council that Trump had appointed him to. And Ken Frazier said, "I'm resigning. Our country's strength stems from its diversity and the contributions made by men and women of different faiths, races, sexual orientations, and political beliefs. America's leaders must honor our fundamental values by clearly rejecting expressions of hatred, bigotry, and group supremacy, which run counter to the American ideal that all people are created equal." Now, Trump was not content to let this man resign and have his moment in the media. And reaching for his Twitter weapon, he slammed Ken Frazier. He said, "Now that Ken Frazier of Merck Pharma has resigned from President's Manufacturing Council, he will have more time to lower rip-off drug prices." Now, this is a man who can't control himself, whose ego is so brittle, whose insecurities are so great, that he has to get even with this guy who did the right thing by resigning from this council, and every other CEO should have resigned, and they should resign now in solidarity with Ken Frazier. I doubt they will. I'd love to see that kind of corporate courage. But after a mini firestorm erupted from those tweets, Trump went to the White House press room. Actually, he went to in front of the cameras. He's still in New Jersey. And he insincerely recited this: "Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans." Now, he could have just as easily said, "and all those other kooks who were featured on Breitbart, which my brain, Steve Bannon, used to run." And I watched a tape of Trump reciting these lines, and it reminded me of on the campaign trail last year when he was pledging his support for the LGBTQ community. He was so unfamiliar with the letters that they did not roll off his twisted little tongue. That's my first reaction to what he said today. And it really was pointless for him to do this, because we know who he is. We know how he thinks. And these are just words designed to paper over the true impression of Donald Trump that we all gleaned over this ugly weekend. And the hate doesn't stop. I actually took a little trip over to one of the alt-right websites, thedailystormer.com. And somebody named Andrew Anglin wrote this piece about Heather Heyer, the 32-year-old. She's been described either as a bankruptcy lawyer or a paralegal. I don't have further details. But this person is so filled with hate and rage and a sense of superiority. I'm going to read parts of this to you, and it is cringeworthy stuff. So they show a picture of her face, and she's a pretty woman. And then they show a picture of her head and shoulders, which show that she was a larger woman. So this hateful Andrew Anglin writes, "She was fat and a drain on society. Despite feigned outrage by the media, most people are glad she is dead, as she is the definition of uselessness. A 32-year-old woman without children is a burden on society and has no value." Wow. "Due to female privilege and the fact that they do virtually nothing their entire lives, women live an average of 5 years longer than men. The average female lifespan is 81 years. That means for 49 more years, this fat slob would have been leeching off of men's work." Just how sick is Andrew Anglin, if that is in fact his real name? "Childless women," quoting again, "are black hole vortexes of public money and energy. Had she not died yesterday, hundreds of thousands of dollars would have been spent on propping up this gross creature who had failed to do her most basic duty, her only real duty, in fact, and reproduce. Having no children at that age, it can be assumed that she had multiple abortions, and thus herself was a child murderer." Now, he's also referred to her as a slut. And this is all done by inference. This is the dark richness, or the rich darkness, of a very twisted mind. "A Dodge Challenger is a fast car. People like Heather, Fatty Fat, are slow, slow, slow. In the video, you can clearly see that most people dodge the charging Dodge. Heather was unable to dodge the Dodge because she was just too fucking fat to really move much at all, according to one observer." Now, this is probably completely made up. I don't know who that observer is, and this dovetails with a rant that I heard from Rush Limbaugh this morning as I was driving to the secret studio. And Rush, who professes to know everything about liberals of every stripe, was there sharing his vast knowledge with his listeners. And he, in a convoluted rap, talked about how identity politics and feminism have created this group of people who feel victimized by the victims of identity politics. And those, by Rush's deduction, are a small group of less educated white males. And that appears to be his rationalization for why this young man drove his charger into the crowd. Now, it does appear that the police didn't do a very good job there. They, at one point, were described by one of the white advocates, as he called himself. "The police were supposed to be there protecting us, and they stood down." The New York Times reports barricades encircling the park and separating the two sides began to come down, and the police temporarily retreated. They described a bunch of officers who were in riot gear maintaining a line, but it wasn't separating the two groups, and it appears that it actually limited their ability to respond to fights and altercations as they broke out. And we still don't have any real explanation as to why the Virginia State Police helicopter crashed. It was apparently conducting surveillance on these events, and we don't know why it was unable to maintain flight. Over at Shadowproof, the young, bright journalist Kevin Gostola makes the connection between this event where people were killed by a ramming vehicle with some of the wacky pieces of legislation that Republicans have introduced in state legislatures this year. It started with Standing Rock, where a North Dakota legislator wanted to basically immunize anyone who ran over a protester with their car because the, you know, implication, the assumption was that these protesters were breaking the law, they were trespassing, and therefore drivers had the right to run them down. That was written by State Representative Keith Kempenich of North Dakota because he said that these protesters were exercising terrorism and that that, for some reason, produce this rationalization that people, therefore, should be able to run them down. But North Dakota wasn't the only place. In Florida, legislators sought to protect a motor vehicle operator who unintentionally causes injury or death to a person who obstructs or interferes with the regular flow of vehicular traffic. And a similar bill was introduced in North Carolina. Now, these, in general, have not passed. Smarter minds, or at least rational thinkers, cool heads, have prevailed. But I believe that these efforts give license to people, some of whom may be a little bit shy of mentally balanced, and it gives them cues and signals that it's okay. I've got approval from my Republican strict parent to mow people down with my car. One of the other reactions is that lefties have become digital vigilantes and using photographs from the march that was held on Friday night and then the altercations that occurred on the streets of Charlottesville on Saturday. They've identified some of the people who showed up. And I find this a really slippery slope. Because if you go to a protest like this, if you march in defense of white rights, and you do so in public, up to a certain point, you are responsible for whatever occurs in reaction to that. But one guy from here in Berkeley, California, Cole White, was identified online. He was photographed among a shouting and torch-wielding mob during the Friday night march. And I don't know exactly how people figured out that he worked at this hot dog joint in Berkeley called Top Dog. And Top Dog is this kind of unusual place because they hire ex-cons and other people. But the owner has a very strong libertarian bent, which is in conflict with the general attitudes in the People's Republic of Berkeley. So there's a sign on the door there that says, effective Saturday, August 12th, Cole White no longer works at Top Dog. The actions of those in Charlottesville are not supported by Top Dog. Now, I don't know if Cole White is a white nationalist, but he's been tagged that without any evidence by the Washington Post. Their article opens with this: a white nationalist who participated in the torch-lit march through the University of Virginia's campus this weekend has been fired from his job at a Berkeley hot dog restaurant. So is Twitter the new McCarthyism? Because I believe that Cole White deserves a presumption of innocence. The fact that he was there and marched, it may mean that he sympathizes with these people. And he was shouting and chanting, but those are First Amendment protected expressions. And should he lose his job because a bunch of Twitter followers climb all over the owner of the restaurant and say he should be fired? And I've seen a lot of vitriol expressed by otherwise progressive individuals in my Facebook feed. And they believe that because these people delve into Nazism and the hateful thoughts and actions of the Ku Klux Klan, that we should be able to just ban them and shut them down. And that is the exact wrong move to make. Number one, these people already feel victimized. They say that Google and other online actors have been censoring their expression. We have the same concern on the left, where Counterpunch and Consortium News and the World Socialist Daily have seen their search traffic, their search engine results drop precipitously. I don't believe that censorship or suppression is the solution, whether the expression is on the left or on the right. And I want to commend Glenn Greenwald. He wrote another great analytical piece. It's at The Intercept. I'm linking to it in the show file for this podcast. And he calls out the misguided attacks on the ACLU for defending the rights of the people who protested. They filed for permits. The government tried to keep their march from taking place. And I do believe that when things skew into violence, the cops and or the National Guard have the right to shut things down. But to do so preemptively, to decide that certain groups are not allowed to assemble, not allowed to speak. I'm sorry, I'm an extremist about the First Amendment, and I reject it. And Greenwald published a bunch of tweets. Here's someone responding to the Virginia situation. Defund the ACLU. Please stop donating to them. Ben Norton, I don't know who Ben is, but he's identified here. The anti-fascists targeted in the white supremacist terror attack today will forever remember the ACLU's position. An apparent female named Shanley, fuck the ACLU. ACLU celebrates causing death to anti-fascists at the hands of Nazi and KKK. Free speech is fascism. And here's where we start to drift into the territory where people on the left embrace the extreme solutions, some of which are codified in the Patriot Act. To use shortcuts, suppression, a belief in the guilt of an individual before it's been proven in a court of law, the idea that people who assemble for free speech are almost by default considered to be potentially violent. And I have grave concerns. As we empower Jeff Sessions to run a civil rights investigation of these events, it preempts the state and local investigations. It allows a guy who has a history of racist expression to put his thumb on the so-called scales of justice. Jeff Sessions is a dirty, dirty guy. He'll use any available means to hold on to his job, to try to please the racist in chief. And so one of the first things on Saturday when I heard, oh yeah, there's going to be a civil rights investigation, Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions III, he'll be right on top of it. And we got this new FBI director who is Chris Christie's lawyer. And we don't know where Chris Ray stands. But these are really troubling developments. And it's interesting because Sessions calls it domestic terrorism. This is another word that was loosely applied by leftists almost as soon as this event occurred. And people are looking for parity. They say, well, you know, Trump is the guy who busts through political correctness to say that it's, Islamic extremist terrorism. And therefore, he should be able to call out a white supremacist who commits an act that people consider to be terrorism. And while I do have concerns that calling it terrorism allows for the whole suite of constitutional violations of government surveillance. We're going to get to read this young man's Facebook posts, I'm sure, in great detail. But the New York Times says the domestic terrorism language is largely symbolic, Many of the law's stiffest penalties are for international terrorism that don't apply domestically. Well, I'm not so sure about that. And I, again, have concerns when people use language in a sloppy way. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And over the weekend I made a visit. I dropped by the post office box about twice a month. And sure enough, like clockwork, Paul Elsesser's monthly contribution is there. He's one of my most generous supporters. But there was also a check from Forbes Johnson. And I hear from Forbes every once in a while when I let people know that I have a major need. A few years ago when my computers blew up, Forbes Johnson came through. And the computer that is recording this podcast is named after you, Forbes. And I want to thank you for your very generous check to help pay for the new mixer board that is on its way here to replace this 20-year-old Yamaha that is fritzing on a daily basis. So, Forbes, the new mixer board's going to be named after you. And I thank you for your very generous contribution. Together with Faith Peoples, who kicked in $50 to help out with the new equipment. So I could use a couple of $100 more to offset this unanticipated expense. And if you're able to kick in, I would very much appreciate it. I was talking about Jeff Sessions a minute ago, and the special election to replace Sessions in the United States Senate has its first outing tomorrow. It's almost destined to go to a runoff. There are 10 or maybe 11 Republicans who are running. And it is such an ugly group of people. It's like, you know, you've got this fairly extreme guy, Luther Strange, who was appointed after he went easy on Governor Bob Bentley and refused to try to impeach him over his sex-charged affair. So Luther Strange got to the interim appointment to the Senate through a very underhanded means. And as Roger Shuler has exposed, Luther Strange is one of those pandering, and also he is a philandering Christian family values politician. And speaking of Roger Shuler, you should read his work as frequently as you care to at legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. He does a great job exposing the corruption in Alabama. And some of the other candidates like Mo Brooks, the conservative congressman, Roy Moore, who's been bounced from the state Supreme Court twice, once because of the Ten Commandments. And then there are a couple of others. Randy Brinson is a Christian coalition leader. State Senator Tripp Pittman. And so it's unclear that anyone can clear the field and get 50% plus one vote to end this tomorrow. But no matter what happens, we're going to get another knuckle-dragging right-wing creep in the U.S. Senate from Alabama. And while we were all distracted by the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend, the FBI popped another frame-up. In Oklahoma City, Jerry Drake Varnell is the man's name, and he was arrested after an early Saturday morning attempt to detonate a fake bomb packed into what he believed was a stolen cargo van outside a bank in Oklahoma City. He is described by his FBI informants. Yes, there was a months-long undercover investigation to set this guy up. And we're told, I mean, they had it all prepared. They've released quotes from his social media, quotes from his comments to his paid FBI informant, and apparently he was a fan of Tim McVeigh. He hated the government. And he decided he didn't want to kill a lot of people like McVeigh did. He just wanted to make a statement by blowing something up. He described it as breaking a couple of eggs to make an omelet. But just like so many other cases, the mention of the paid FBI informant in this Washington Post story appears in the third paragraph. And that's the tip-off. But this was not some organic crime. Now, I don't know the race of the suspect here, Mr. Varnell, but I highly suspect that he is white. And it is white extremists in this country who've been identified as the greatest threat from so-called domestic terrorism. Has Trump acknowledged that? I think not. One of America's longest incarcerated political prisoners, Mumia Abu-Jamal, may have a new track to win his release. He has always professed his innocence in the killing of the Philadelphia cop Daniel Faulkner way back in 1981. And what is fascinating is to see the corruption in the criminal justice system in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania. Ed Rendell, who became the centrist Democratic governor after being Philadelphia's district attorney and mayor, well, he is considered by one of Mumia's lawyers to be directly responsible for the frame-up. And after Rendell moved up the political ladder, he handed off the management of the Mumia problem to Ronald Castile, the district attorney there in Philly, the prosecutor. Castile now sits as the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and he has ruled on a number of cases, including Mumia's, despite frequent requests for him to recuse himself on grounds of bias and conflict of interest. And now we have a case, a precedent-setting case, I believe it's from the U.S. Supreme Court, that says that this is obviously inappropriate, and that Castile is, the argument is, has violated the fundamental precept that a prosecutor involved in the case should never sit as a judge on the same case. So I'm mildly optimistic that we might see some progress there. So you know how we've been told that Trump has these themes of the week and he never sticks to them? Well, last week it emerged that he actually stuck to the theme because it was Threaten North Korea Week. And in the series of tweets and public comments to reporters, we saw Trump really ratchet up the risk of a conflict with North Korea. Now, allies and adversaries have all dissed Trump over this, some of them wary of calling him out by name, nonetheless make strong comments like Angela Merkel of Germany. Germany will be intensively involved in any possible non-military solutions, but I consider an escalation of words to be the wrong answer. But what I have not seen adequately reported and highlighted is that China appears to have quietly issued a checkmate to both Trump and Kim. Because in an editorial in one of the house organs of the Chinese government in Beijing on Friday, they announced that if the United States invaded or attacked North Korea, that China would defend North Korea. But if North Korea provokes the United States, and I believe they specifically mention the threat of attacking or sending missiles toward Guam, then China would remain neutral. This is a brilliant stroke, because it checkmates the United States and threatens or counter-threatens that China would block Trump from first strike on North Korea. And it warns North Korea that if you do something stupid, we're going to sit there and watch you get pummeled. I think that this is the most significant international announcement of the last week, and it has been all but buried by our corporate media. News Today, part of this is based on leaks from the intelligence community and part on a new study from Michael Ellman, or Ellman, a missile expert at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And what Ellman, I'll call him Ellman, what he reports is that North Korea, over the last year, gave up on its homegrown rocket engines and was able on the international black market to acquire a number of rocket engines made at a facility in Ukraine. in the Donbass, on the border of Russia, is a factory called Yuzmash. And Yuzmash used to make rocket engines for the Russian military, but they've fallen on hard times, and we're told that they have unpaid bills and low morale. So if North Korea got them the cash, it's possible that they sold them some engines. Now, what I find interesting about this article, and I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast, please peruse it yourselves. It's written by David Sanger, the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, and Bill Broad, who is a very talented and credible science and technology writer, whom I've had the pleasure of interviewing in the past. But what I find interesting about this article is it starts off in a tentative mode, saying, according to this report and according to intelligence assessments. And by the end of the article, it's just shifted into flat assertions. How the Russian-designed engines got to North Korea is still a mystery. Well, wait a minute. You didn't prove that these were Russia-designed engines made in Ukraine. This is speculation. So despite that, this story may be true. And I find it fascinating, so check it out. Meanwhile, Trump's threat week is backfiring once again in Venezuela. In a gratuitous add-on remark on Friday, Trump said, "Oh yeah, Venezuela is not very far away. The people are suffering. They're dying. We have many options for Venezuela, including a possible military option if necessary." This is all that Maduro needs to cement his grip on power. And while you know I'm generally sympathetic to the socialist enterprise in Venezuela, I am concerned about the aggregation of power by Nicolas Maduro at the expense of opponents. It's not democratic. That doesn't mean the United States should invade or participate in any effort to destabilize or take down the Maduro government. But Trump has put Mike Pence on the road to South America, and his first stop is Colombia, where the foreign ministry said Colombia opposes any military measures and the use of force in efforts to resolve the Venezuela problem. And even Lindsey Graham said, "What? Can I use a mock Southern accent without offending my Southern listeners? I'm open-minded to a reason, but at the end of the day, our military should be deployed when there's a national security interest that can be articulated to the American people. I don't see one in Venezuela in terms of the military force." Meanwhile, the new sanctions aimed at Iran have had exactly the opposite of the desired effect, as the parliament voted unanimously yesterday to increase spending on its ballistic missile program. Yes, carrying a big stick and tweeting out threats, it's real effective. Really, really effective. There was a weird event on Friday at the White House, which, of course, is mostly vacant and being remodeled while Trump is away. A guy named Rich Higgins, a protege of Steve Bannon, was bounced after he wrote a memo alarmingly warning of a deep state government cabal, a leftist cabal of globalist bankers and adherents to Islamic fundamentalism, conspiring to remove President Trump and impose cultural Marxism in the United States. Now, I want to say that his rant was largely hysterical. But some of it, if you apply it to the Trump-Russia narrative, makes a little bit of sense. Front pager on Sunday's New York Times, actually it was Saturday, about staff members at the EPA, more than 20, who were interviewed by the New York Times and who said that Scott Pruitt is running a very secretive organization. If you get a meeting with the top dog on the seventh floor, you have to be cleared now because it's locked out. And you're told to leave your cell phone behind and not to take any notes if you're meeting with the director. And they also say that many of the longtime staffers are knuckling under. For example, in relation to the wetlands of Chesapeake Bay. On June 13th, economists at the EPA were verbally told to produce a new study that changed the wetlands benefit. On June 16th, they did what they were told. They produced a new cost-benefit analysis that showed no quantifiable benefit to preserving wetlands. So he's doing a whole lot of damage, one of the lead members of the Trump wrecking crew. And finally today, Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, gave a rousing speech to the Netroots Nation group meeting in Atlanta on Saturday. And it was a Bernie Sanders speech. Now, I give credit to Elizabeth Warren, at least at this stage. She is willing to attack the Democratic establishment and say that this idea of a third way, a moderate way, a renewal of the Democratic Leadership Council from the Clinton 90s is not the way to go. Apparently, she said, ridiculing the proposal last week for this new centrist organization, apparently the path forward is to go back to locking up nonviolent drug offenders and ripping more holes in our economic safety net. She said the system is rigged when the black-white wealth gap triples over the past three decades, when racist voter ID laws and voter suppression tactics sprout like weeds all across the country, when a man too racist to become a judge in the 80s now runs the Department of Justice. That's Jeff Sessions. When communities like Flint are living with poisoned water and polluted air, when there's still no justice for Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, Philando Castile, and so many more. She criticized Democrats who had to... We're not going back to the days when a Democrat who wanted to run for a seat in Washington first had to grovel on Wall Street. Now, that is a clear swipe at the Clinton campaign from last year. She embraces labor rights, mentions unions. She talks about single-payer health care and Medicare for all as the standard for the Democratic Party. And all of this is great. But, Liz, where were you last year? We had a candidate running who backed all of these things that you espouse. And you remained silent. You stayed on the sidelines. You wouldn't endorse Bernie Sanders. Because you believed that Hillary was going to win and you feared her retribution more than standing up for the people who you are now so brilliantly representing. Can we trust you, Senator Warren? Thanks for listening to my News and Comment podcast. It's available on YouTube. Did you know? I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.